And welcome back. This is Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our very special guest today is General Sir Peter Cosgrove. Sir Peter was widely known for his career in the Australian Defence Force, where he reached the very top, retiring as the Chief of the Defence Force in 2005. Soon after retiring from the Army, Sir Peter was invited to take charge of the huge relief and rebuilding operation in Queensland after the devastation of Cyclone Larry. And then in 2014, Sir Peter became the 26th Governor-General of Australia, where he served until 2019. In retirement, Sir Peter is actively involved with defence, health and other charitable organisations, enjoying some time with his family, which includes three grandchildren. His new memoir, covering in more detail his extraordinary life, is called You Shouldn't Have Joined. So, Peter, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Bill, and good to talk to another wave earlier.
Yes, it goes back a long way. So, having read about your extraordinarily full and eventful life, I would have to say about the title, You Shouldn't Have Joined, really?
Yep, look, I knew it would raise eyebrows, and I put it in deliberately for that reason, because the full saying tells its own little story. Now, imagine a group of soldiers standing in front of you. Make it a 50. Just pluck that number out of the air. And they're waiting for the company sergeant major to turn up to give them jobs for the day. And they're not looking forward to it, because they reckon they always get crook jobs, hard jobs, dirty jobs. And they think, oh, here we go again. Here comes the sergeant major, he gives them the jobs, and all of their fears are met, they are fulfilled, they're rotten jobs. So they're all standing there with long faces, and the CSM looks at them, and in that old army way, says this to them: come on, you guys, let's get stuck into it. You shouldn't have joined if you can't take a joke. And that is an emblem of the fact that in the army, people have to do whatever job is needed of them, and we hope they will do it cheerfully and with a smile on their face and cracking a joke along the way. It's therefore, if you like, an emblem of the wonderful period of time I spent in the Australian Army. I loved it, every moment of it. There were some moments which were crook, tough, unhappy. But if I had to not have the career to avoid the unhappy times, I'd have done it over and over again. I would have still stayed in the Army.
Well, I remember when Bob Hawke left office and he said one of the hardest adjustments was having to iron his own shirts. What have you found hardest since you ended up your time as Governor-General in 2019?
Not the shirt issue, no. I'm not bad at shirts. They train you on that in the Army. So I can whisk an iron over stuff pretty quickly, and even did it from time to time when I was Governor-General, because while we got assistance in this regard, sometimes you needed it right now, so put up the ironing board and get stuck in. Look, the real adjustment for me was to find things to do which kept me bubbling along. I didn't want to go and sit in the corner of the garden. I did not want to withdraw totally from sight. I did not want to become some kind of travelling hermit. I really wanted to experience, I suppose, a less programmed existence, because one of the things about being Governor-General is your time is absolutely diarised and programmed from first thing in the morning till last thing at night, every day of the week.
Well, going back to your school days at Waverley College, did you ever consider a career other than the Army?
Yeah, I did. I did the leaving certificate twice in 63 and 64. 63 I passed, but I didn't get a good pass, and I was really immature. And 64 was sort of, yeah, got to leave now. So I thought of journalism, I thought of being a policeman, I thought of being a teacher, I thought of being a lawyer, and I thought of being in the Army. And they're all, to me, interesting careers. Some of them, were important in the use of language in particular. Well, let's imagine being a teacher or a lawyer or a journalist, you're using language. All of them were to do with people. So I didn't think that at the time, but it occurred to me later that every one of those potential career paths was to do with people. So I suppose you could say I needed to do something that wasn't about objects or, you know, a closeted job where you sort of look at the wall or look at a screen.
Well, when you left Duntroon for the first time, you were posted to Malaysia and it was almost a diplomatic role, but after 7 months you found yourself a platoon commander in Vietnam.
Yeah, look, I'd been a platoon commander in Malaya as well, which was good because we did a lot of work in the jungle. Obviously, Malaya is covered in jungle. We used to go to some of the toughest, most impenetrable jungle you'd find anywhere. We would train there, but this was not a war. So the training was arduous in the sense of you're operating in the jungle, but we weren't getting shot at. So it was a fantastic preparation, further preparation, for when I went to Vietnam, which was a little bit by surprise in the middle of the year.
And were you keen to get into Vietnam and get into battle situations?
Oh, cracking my neck. Let's be clear. No person who hasn't been in combat knows what it's like. So you've got a lump in your throat at the whole thought. But that's what you've joined the army to do. And part of being in the infantry is that when there's fighting to be done, you expect the infantry to be involved somehow in that fighting. And, you know, you're dead keen because you've been doing all this training and you believe you're ready. You don't know, but you want to find out. So going to a war zone is something that young officers find themselves wanting to do because that's one of the reasons why they joined the army. They felt they could do that in their country's uniform.
Well, in the army, you have to follow orders. What do you do if... I mean, it doesn't seem to have occurred to you in your career, but what if there's someone who you report to who's someone you don't respect? How do you get around that situation?
Well, that can happen in any walk of life. You have more options in a civilian environment. You possibly have your options limited by economics in the civilian environment. In the military, it's limited by the oath of obedience you take and the fact that you are operating within a disciplined system. So you often will try to make best. And it's not beyond the realm of possibility that if the person you're working for is objectively not a good boss, you may be able to find reasons and work with that person in a way which brings from them better decisions. That sounds so pompous. However, because it's a fact of life that sometimes there'll be a boss who isn't the best or even very good and not able to be respected, well, you still have to try to work with that person. There are also areas of redress. If there are real reasons, apart from feelings that you might have, if there are real reasons why the person isn't a good boss, you can seek redress. It's... obviously a difficult thing to do because the fact that the person's a superior means somebody else thought that they were worth making or giving them command of you and whatever other men you've got. So it's a troubling matter. I haven't been particularly overborne by that during my time. You correctly deduce from what I've written that I've been lucky in that regard. I also like to think that by and large there aren't too many who are ratbags and that you can't work up some respect and a lot of obedience for.
Well, was it difficult, I'm sure it was, to find yourself in command of battle-hardened soldiers when you were only 7 months out of Duntroon on arriving in Vietnam? How did you get their respect?
It was a bit intimidating, Bill. it was intimidating on one sense, but on another sense, imagine this. I thought, okay, this is not the blind leading the blind. This might be the blind. I might be the blind. We're yet to find out whether I could do this stuff, but they're experienced. So they will know stuff, which when we get into battle, is going to be very useful. They'll have done it before. It's only me that has to sort of come up with the goods. And you knew that as sure as night follows day, it was going to happen because that was the rhythm of the war, that the infantry, the Australian infantry in our province, if you were diligent and good enough in your field craft, you would find a moment when battle was inevitable because you'd have the drop on somebody or you'd sneak up on them and then it was on for young and old. Now, but I did understand that these soldiers would be looking at me with very keen eyes, very critical eyes, because their concern would be, what about if I was an idiot? What about if I was a coward? What about if I was rash? What about if I froze? All of these things. That would be terrible for them because it increases the risk to them. And it would be ruinous for me, of course. But, that's a natural thing. And there's not too much you can do to alleviate that, except in the lead-up towards when eventually battle is inevitable. So when you're in those days and days and days when you're sneaking around, not knowing when it might occur, during all that phase, you, the officer, are doing professional, good things, and therefore, if you like, boosting the confidence of the soldiers that when the shots ring out, you might well react in a positive way.
And we have the great privilege today of speaking with General Sir Peter Cosgrove about his new memoir called You Shouldn't Have Joined. We normally take a break about this part of the program and we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. There is a song you mention in the book, Those Were the Days by Mary Hopkin. Are you happy if we run with that, Sir Peter?
Yes. Would you like me to put some context on that for your listeners?
I would very much like that.
Okay. Well, it was not perhaps the best of all time song. It was a pop song of its time. And the pop singer, Mary Hopkin, sings this ballad-type song. It bounces along, but the theme of it, as Bill has said, those were the days. It's a reminiscence. And at the end of our time at Duntroon, 4 years as comrades in arms, now going off to the four winds, to different parts of Australia, different parts of the army, and eventually a lot of us off to Vietnam, but all in probably in different units. So, if you like, the class of 1968, that's what we were saying farewell to Duntroon, but farewell to each other for a while, knowing we'd bump into each other down the track. And this song was sung at a somewhat riotous dinner we had with the whole of the cadet body there, us, the graduating class, and all the other junior classes there, and the whole mob sang it in the mess, and it was roared out by people who were saying in the pop tune of the day, farewell to Duntroon, farewell to each other, and go with God.
And I happen to know it was a popular song of another senior army person that I knew personally, Brigadier Paddy O'Hare. So let's listen to Those Were the Days by Mary Hopkin.
Remember how we laughed away the hours.
And that was Those Were the Days by Mary Hopkin. And we are speaking today with General Sir Peter Cosgrove about his new memoir called You Shouldn't Have Joined. Over your career, you were aide-de-camp, or you described that as being a valet, to Governor-General Sir Paul Hasluck, and then you were military assistant to the Chief of the General Staff. Did you use these people as role models when you rose to the positions they were occupying?
Oh, I certainly remembered as much as I could about my time as ADC, not a valet. A valet would be doing the shoes and the trousers. Mm-hmm. I was sort of at his side and helping to plan his itinerary. But I went to town on everything I could remember from my time at Yarralumla. Sir Paul was a great man. He's a different fellow to me. He would probably find me somewhat boisterous, maybe even flamboyant. He was, though, a tremendous intellect. And he spoke brilliantly at the many times that I was by his side and he was out in the community. He was a very dignified fellow. He absolutely represented the role of first citizen to all of the political class of people in Canberra, many of whom would come as guests to Yarralumla. So we got to know those sort of folks. So prime ministers and leaders of the opposition and senators and members of the upper and lower house, ministers all over the place. I try to remember all that and how you dealt with them and their relationship they had with the Governor-General, and I expected that that would be quite similar for when I was dealing with those contemporary people as Governor-General. Yes, I did remember that. And who was the other character you mentioned to me that I might have taken as a role model?
Oh, when you were military assistant to the Chief of General Staff.
Oh, well, that was very good too, in the sense that I was dealing frequently with the very senior military people, and from time to time, you know, we would have overseas visitors, so there was a protocol involved in that as well. And when my boss, the Chief of Army, went overseas, I have to tell you that the poor old ADC to him, a captain, was told he could mind the shop while the Lieutenant Colonel, that was me, went overseas. So I acted like the boss's ADC when we were overseas. And he went reasonably frequently because I was the note-taker and all that sort of thing, the carrier of classified documents and the advisor to the boss about what was going to happen the next day. So being a bit closer to him in age than the poor old ADC, I performed both duties. So, yes, it was very... very instructive to me about protocol and how you interact with overseas people.
Well, when you returned to Duntroon, this time as commander, you thought it would be your last job before retirement, but then that certainly changed when you got the call to go to East Timor, where you were commander of Interfet. And at that time, did you realise that you had to be aware of the politics that were all around you?
Absolutely, yep. I was aware of it, but I had a very straightforward military mission. It was straightforward in enunciation, very complex in execution. The straightforward part was restore security in East Timor and provide a shelter behind which the United Nations can return to East Timor. So provide security and get the United Nations back up and running as the temporary administrators of this brand new country. That's straightforward. It only takes a few seconds to say it. Very, very complex because of all the stakeholders and nuances. The stakeholders were obviously the East Timorese, the United Nations, Indonesia, and the 22 nations that comprised the force. Some of them were only one or two people as their representatives, but there was a flag on a flagpole. Others of them had more than 1,000 troops. So, you know, we were in that complex situation. There was politics all around me, but everybody was monitoring rather than interfering. Can I put it that way? So my job was to achieve the confidence of every troop contributing nation, of the East Timorese, of course, and in relation to the Indonesians, not so much their confidence, because they were wounded by the whole experience, but, if you like, their acquiescence that, look, this fellow isn't running around waving a red rag at a bull. He's actually looking to do this in a matter-of-fact but sensitive way. And we set out to do that. Part of my job was to ensure people didn't go too much hubris about what they were doing, because we were there with the permission of the UN or the encouragement of the UN, the encouragement of our own nations, and the Indonesians had acquiesced fairly completely to the wishes of the Security Council in vacating East Timor, which was fundamentally what we needed them to do. Yeah, very sensitive, and I've never felt more alive.
Well, I expect you would have been working with the civilian authorities there, and perhaps there's going to be a greater role for the Australian Defence Forces to work with civilian authorities. I'm thinking of the Pung Su incident you talked about, and there's also perhaps the Lint Cafe siege. Yeah. Do you see that greater role for the ADF?
Yes, but always with the complete visibility by the levels of government. The military should make sure governments of all stripes are aware of its capabilities, but should never push itself into a domestic situation. It has to be a judgment call made by responsible government that on this occasion will get the military to come in and do something. And I'm springboarding here off your reference to, very obviously, and in New South Wales in particular, the Lint Cafe. Before that, the Pung Su, which was that Korean vessel that was implicated in a murder or a death, and certainly a very large amount of drugs that were landed ashore, probably, and I think it's been shown by the court, certainly by that vessel. And the vessel then absconded and had to be brought into arrest. And it's very hard to arrest a 5,000-ton ship out on the high seas with your ordinary forces of law and order, and the military was needed.
Well, you were appointed Governor-General in 2014, and in the next 5 years, 3 months, you travelled to 40 countries and met the leaders representing Australia. Just a topical question, did you ever meet Donald Trump and Joe Biden?
Yes, I did. Joe Biden came here in the latter days of the Obama administration, therefore he was the sitting Vice President. And he made a visit to Australia, and we hosted him in Sydney at Admiralty House, and we had the great and the good from our land, from Australia, attend a lovely evening dinner. So it was sort of like a state occasion with the nature of the people who came to the function, and we were saluting our strong relationship with the United States. And we found Mr. Biden to be very pleasant, and he was a most agreeable guest. So I can say I met him, and he was my dinner partner, sitting next to me at the table at Admiralty House. I met Mr. Trump very briefly on the 11th of November 2018 at the Presidential Palace in Paris. So it was the Élysée Palace. It was after a major international ceremony to commemorate the end of World War One. That was done at the Arc de Triomphe, and just about all of the heads of state of the nations which were swept up in World War One were there. The British were having their own ceremony, so the royal family and the political leadership from UK were doing the same sort of thing at the same time, but in London. But we had Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin, Macron, of course, from France, a great friend. It was just a sort of a stellar cast of heads of state. And I met Mr. Trump at the lunchtime event.
When you were appointed Sir Peter, did you find that changed the way people related to you?
A little bit, but I managed to avoid, I think, a lot of the harsh words that accompanied that decision by the Prime Minister of the day, because I don't particularly ascribe to airs and graces. I ascribe to dignity, but not taking yourself too seriously. And I realised that with the appending of the title, Sir Peter, that I was going to be a mouthful of a person to be introduced. So the title just ran on and on and on. Mm. And I realised that this would be an impediment if it was even suspected of hiding behind it with the people I met. So I would operate always in public with an eye to the fact that this is a man who, yes, he's honoured to be the first citizen of the nation, but he's not stuck up. He is approachable. He wants you to come and say hello, and his wife is exactly the same. I believe it made me work even harder to connect with people, so nobody would be put off by the thought that, oh, you know, here comes some bunyip aristocrat.
Look, there are so many things we could talk about. I do recommend to everybody this book called You Shouldn't Have Joined by General Sir Peter Cosgrove, because, I mean, among other things, Sir Peter comments on the fluctuating push to become a republic and gives us an insight into the life of a governor-general, which is very far removed from most of us. As I said, we've run out of time, but I'd like to give a very special thank you to you, Sir Peter. Thank you very much for joining us on Dad's on the Air.
I'm delighted to have been on Dad's on the Air, and particularly to talk to a fellow who joined Waverley College in the same year as I did. All the best to you, Bill, and all your listeners.
Thank you very much. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.